Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus. We're recording Wednesday, May 18th for publication tomorrow on the 19th. I just got back from Sweden. We just slugged through a whole group of headlines. There's a lot going on, John. We got a very interesting theme today. Tell us what it is.
The theme is, you know, between Scylla and Charybdis, a story from ancient Greece, also popularized by the song by the Police in the early 80s.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, rap. That's how I know how to pronounce it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, so I always say Scylla and Charybdis, so I'm sure I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, incorrectly. But it was inspired by, I was in Sweden, as we'll give a report on Malmo, Sweden later tonight. And there was a huge baseball going back about whether or not Finland and Sweden would apply to NATO. And of course, any freedom fighter there was, and all the Swedes were just praying that they wouldn't apply for membership. And of course they did. And the Finnish president came out and gave a very astute interview that we're going to cover today. The links are in the sheet that you provide, where he said there's no more room for the unaligned. And so in the shift to the multipolar world and the fight by the G7 nation to preserve a unipolar world, it's either you're in their team or you're in our team. There's no more space for neutrality. And to have the Finnish president say there's no place to be neutral, that's a pretty scary world. And and you can see that both the leadership of Sweden and Finland were between these two options, none of which were neither attraction is attractive, but you're trying to navigate between the two of them and they can't find the space for the neutral.
Right. Right. You're right. There's the Finland prime minister, the head of state, Sauli Niinistö. He did put it very well. But that theme, Scylla and Charybdis, also shows up in a story about the ASEAN nations, and in particular Indonesia, because Indonesia is the only one of the ASEAN nations that's a member of the G20, and it's now got a lot of pressure from the U.S. to blackball Russia in the G20.
Right. Right. So as the system centralizes, we're all faced with these horrible trade-offs. And the question for all of us is, how do we just break free of both of them?
Right.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway.
We're bushwhacking.
We have a lot of stories to cover this week, a couple more than normal. So some stories we're going to get through quickly, like the first few here, and some will require a little more background and explanation. Anyway, the first story here is from The Saker. This is a quick story. Can you see that?
Right. So instead of Russia halting the European gas, Ukraine halts a third. And this happened right after Rand Paul blocked the $40 billion.
This is right. There's a couple of stories where it's like, well, this seems like blackmail. This is Ukraine. So this is The Saker. This is just too delicious not to sit rep quickly. Ukraine calls force majeure and halts one-third of European gas. And the interesting thing is, Kiev says, you know, there's a force majeure in Lugansk. We need to halt a third of the gas flow to Europe. And Gazprom says, what are you talking about? There's no issue in the line. No problem at all there. What's up? And so it looks like a situation where Ukraine has just stepped in and said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to play a game of hostage here. We know there's $40 billion sitting here, and we'll just deny gas until we get what we want.
So when Rand Paul put the block, you know, he can't stop it, but he can delay it. When a group of senators moved to put the block, you know what it felt like? It felt like that first vote on the bailouts. And organized crime is coming in and insisting on their shakedown payment or else.
Yep.
So whoever is in control of the Ukraine, as far as I'm concerned, it's organized crime.
Right. And we're going to see another story where we're seeing more and more of these stories that really highlight the fact that Ukraine is a cesspool of fraud and corruption and some very dark, nefarious dealings.
Right.
So this is, you know, a game of hostage over there, shakedown. That's par for the course in Ukraine.
Right.
Okay. All right. Next story, also in the war in Ukraine. This from Al Rabiya News. Anyway, this is a very straightforward story. It's basically Russia to cut electricity to Finland from Saturday, according to a supplier. This is very straightforward. We are forced to suspend the electricity import starting from May 14th, says a subsidiary of Russian state energy holding Interrao said in a statement, adding that it had not received payment for volumes sold in May. So, in other words, you just have to pay for your gas or your electricity. You're not going to get any electricity. We're not going to give away energy. You need
to
pay for
it. So it's very interesting. The article says they were not, that Finland was not able to make the payments. So the question is, what are the Western banks doing to prevent those payments from getting through? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
But I mean, not.
One thing I can tell you about Finland is they can afford to pay for their electricity.
They may not be able to afford to pay it the way they want to pay it.
Right.
Remember, you have to go to Gazprom Bank in that jurisdiction, in Russia. You're not gonna pay it through a bank where you can just freeze the payment. You can forget that. That's off the table. That's been off the table for a while. So I don't know what Finland's talking about. The rules are very clear, and if you're not getting gas, as far as I'm concerned, or electricity, it's your own fault. You've known about this for a month, and this hasn't been a problem until now. This is on you.
Yeah, but remember, Finland and Russia are 1 second apart.
Right.
Whatever they have to do to walk it across the border, they can. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
This is another story. Next one, continuing the war in Ukraine, another game of hostage from Erdogan. Turkish veto to Sweden and Finland in NATO, and they've done that today. So they've went ahead and made good on their threat to veto, you know, the application to NATO. Turkey opposes Sweden and Finland joining NATO, accuses them of being a haven for Kurdish terrorists. They could have accused them of anything. He could have accused them of not, you know, being good on climate or anything else. He just made this threat. This is another shakedown, looks like to me.
So, yeah, so it clearly, he's clearly toll booting them. You know, he wants, he's going to extract his pound of flesh. But it was really funny because when it went around, it was literally, and all these people, and so here I am in southern Sweden. We have a lot of Swedes, a lot of people from Denmark, literally among the group that as the information hits it, you know, they're ready to cheer. And all of a sudden we turned to each other and said, oh, my God, we're feeling warm thoughts toward Erdogan. Who would have ever imagined that could happen?
Right. Right. Yeah. Who would imagine that could happen?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. The next story, this is an involved story, and it's a very serious story. And this is concerns the bio labs that Russia found in Ukraine, the biowarfare labs. So this is the statement from the permanent mission of Russian Federation to the UN, a statement by Vasily Nebenzia at UN Security Council on the laboratories, the bio labs in Ukraine. And he calls them threats to international peace and security. I want to highlight some of the details in this, but the basic headline here is we keep receiving, this is Russia speaking now, we keep receiving very worrisome documental evidence that the U.S. DOD is directly involved in implementing in Ukraine dangerous biological projects that have characteristic features of a secret military biological program. Neither the Ukraine nor the U.S. submitted to the U.N. any information about these activities with respect to their biological warfare reports. Our special military operation was able to stop this dangerous activity. And I'll scroll down here to some of the darker allegations. Again, Russia speaking here. We conducted an investigation of an incident that occurred in the Slavyanoborsky district in the LPR, that's Lugansk, in 2020, as it turns out, Stepovo village flyers made in the form of counterfeit currency notes were infected with the tuberculosis agent and distributed among minors. The idea was that after handling money, children often handle food without washing their hands first. They also rub their eyes and their noses. Another episode that once again demonstrates how the Kiev regime and its Western sponsors really feel about the people of Ukraine. A U.S. scientist from a laboratory in Marifa tested potentially dangerous biological drugs on patients of the regional clinical psychiatric hospital number 3, then another one at hospital number 1. It was a group of male patients from 40 to 60 years old with a high stage of physical exhaustion. The research was secret. All involved personnel, the medical personnel, had to sign non-disclosure agreements in order to conceal their U.S. affiliation. The researchers traveled via third countries. So, in other words, the people right. involved in this research know that they're up to no good, and they're trying to hide it. And now right. it's coming out.
Right. So this is a very serious link, because you have the official Russian government website making yep. a presentation to the Security Council of the United States with all the leading countries, and making the information public. And given where the Russians have been for the last 30 to 60 days, they clearly have the documents. They clearly have the evidence behind this.
Yeah, and I want to...
Yeah, go
let
ahead.
Let me cut to a graphic to sort of details how involved this is and how Russia's mapped it out, because it's serious, and they're naming names. They're not right. Russia's not playing around with this.
Right.
So here's sort of a chart that sort of walks you through it. And Russia's saying, you know, look, it's basically, it starts here with these research companies, you know, Pfizer, pharmaceutical companies, Lilly, Merck, Moderna, all the suspects.
Right.
The money goes over here. It goes to the politicians, Obama, Biden, Hillary Clinton, George Soros. You know, the defense, you know, you have U.S. agencies involved, Defense Department, Ministry of Agriculture, and they map out the whole thing.
Right.
They've got the whole thing mapped out of, like, what's going on here.
Right.
So it's, you know, Russia's not playing around with this.
Right. And, you know, one of the interesting things, if you read Kennedy's book on some of the experimentation done to people in the United States, it's clear this infrastructure within the U.S. government is perfectly capable and has consistently been doing this and been part or supportive of people like the Gates Foundation doing it, you know, in India and other countries in Africa. And this is genocide. You know,
yeah.
their goal may not be genocide. It may just be experimentation of biological warfare. Who knows? But this is genocide. And it's going to get pretty well documented, and with the money linking back to specific people. So
right.
it will be interesting to see how this plays out.
Right. I thought it was also interesting in that story. I mean, just aside from the horrific nature of it, experimenting on your own children in Ukraine and compromised adults, aside from that, very interesting that they are spreading biological warfare agents on currency notes. Clearly an attack, you know, part and parcel of the ongoing war on cash.
So the number one conversation this weekend was, what are the procedures by which the U.S. amends the WHO treaty and organization so that instead of waiting 2 years to implement global control through the World Health Organization, they can do it this year? And one of my concerns is the reason they're trying to literally convert to one world dictatorship through the WHO and the UN is they are very afraid of that they're losing control of the situation now, and they need to do something now.
Right.
Right.
It does not look good right now. And we have an election in the U.S. coming up where it's not looking so good from the very people the Russia just fingered.
They're going to lose big. And if they lose control of both the House and Senate, we're going to see hearings on this in the U.S. Senate,
right,
or House, or both.
Right. So I don't think it's any accident that you're starting
right.
to see, you know, flare-ups of the you-know-what, the virus,
well,
the oh-my-God virus.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if the $40 billion was what they needed to rig the campaign. In other words, Ukraine is shaking down for $40 billion. What's that money really going to be used for? And
yep.
it could be to do these various things they need to maintain control. So
who knows? But that's
yeah.
a lot of money. If you add up all the money we poured
right.
into Ukraine, it's more than Russia's annual military budget.
Well, here's the thing. It's why Powell said, you know, you break it, you fix it. Or, no, you break it, you own it. It's very
yeah.
expensive to finance the entire governmental operations and civic infrastructure of a country after you've destroyed it.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Okay. Let's keep it going. The next story, right on theme. This is what we were talking about from the last refuge.
Right.
Sunday talks. Finland President Sauli Niinistö indicates global cleaving behind decision to join NATO. And here's really the money quote. Let me try that one more time. There we go. What we see now, Europe, the world is more divided. That there's not very much room for non-aligned in between. So that's what we were also thinking of. You go, we got to make a choice, and we're making a choice. And I want to cut to what, you know, you could really see this in a graph. Mm-hmm. When you look at the graph of the Russian currency and other currencies, look at this.
Yep.
You can see, you know, you've got the, I'm going to use blue. Okay. So here's when the Russia special operation, the invasion started. Okay. And now since then, look at the two best performers.
Right.
It's the ruble here and the two people on the side of the war are doing well, and Europe is going down, right?
So the other day, earlier this week, the dollar index spiked to 105, which is
wow.
is frightening. It backed wow. right back down to 103, but it was quite an interday spike. So the U.S. dollar unbelievably strong, the ruble even stronger. So,
yeah, but yeah. But they're both going up. In other words, if you're sort of in between, you're caught in right. the middle. You're between Scylla right. and Charybdis. You're sinking.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And they are.
Yeah.
The
right.
pressure.
So Finland's like, well, okay.
The pressure, and I the reason I wanted to really point out that interview, and I recommend it strongly, is he says right up front, we're not worried about it being invaded with Russia. We're not worried about security issues.
Yeah.
There's no military problem here. He makes that very clear. But what he is saying is there's two economic blocks, and you
right.
can't stay outside. You know, you got to go with one or the other.
Right. It's economic warfare. Right.
Right. It's a very astute, effective interview, and it really helps you understand the squeeze these folks are in.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And in a certain extent, he's talking about a country, but the squeeze is the same for every family in the world.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And it's certainly not, it's not even limited to Europe. And we'll see that in a little bit, too.
Right. You and I, we're all, everybody listening to this, we're all in the same squeeze box.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Okay. Last story, I believe, in war in Ukraine. This really goes to the propaganda. So there's the steel plant in Mariupol, and the people holding out, the Ukrainian soldiers holding out, have finally given up.
Right.
Okay. And they've given up, and you can see this in the story. However, the press chooses to characterize this is they just evacuated. Those fighters just evacuated. There's no sign of surrender. But if you scroll down in the story, you can see that the Russians describe, the state media says, look, it was an order from the Ukrainian military command for its troop to surrender, okay? And even if you said, you know what, I don't really trust Russian state media, even though, as we've said again, these people don't bluff that much, the tell is here. So where are the soldiers going to go? Are they going to go home to Ukraine? No, they're not going to go home to Ukraine. They're going to a nearby town, which is controlled by Russian-backed separatists. Another 211 were transferred to another Russian-aligned village. Okay? That's where they're going,
right.
according to Ukraine's defense minister. And why would they be going there? Well, I'll tell you why. They're going there because they're going to be questioned by
right.
the Russian military about
this
what is going
debriefing.
On.
This is called debriefing.
It's called debriefing. They're going to Russian-controlled
yeah.
areas.
Right.
This was a surrender.
Right.
But the press hammers, again, evacuation over and over and over. It's just an evacuation. We just evacuated.
So another question based on intuition. $40 billion gets holed up. Suddenly, this happens. In between, is there a relationship between 102? So my understanding is there's 102,000 mercenaries in the Ukraine fighting on the Ukraine side.
Right.
So we're talking about a very significant Ukrainian effort. Suddenly, the $40 billion gets held up after a week where everybody's running around like a chicken. It's desperate. It's desperate. It's desperate. You know, if those guys don't get paid, they walk off the job.
Right.
Right. So
that's how it works with mercenaries, right?
Yes, it does.
There's no such thing as AWOL with a mercenary. It's pay as you go.
Right.
Right.
So that's my question: was the delay in that $40 billion? Contributing to bringing down the mercenary defense.
It probably included that. Yeah.
Right. Right.
I think there were $40 billion a lot of scratch, and it went to a lot of other things.
Right.
But yeah, there's no doubt that some mercenaries are smart enough to think, you know, hey, you know, we need, you got to pay to play.
Right. But the other thing is, if you stiff a mercenary, you get scared. Right. So if you look at the chicken with the head cut off thing that was going on in Washington, and it had that feel to it. I mean, I've sat and watched a cabinet secretary be blackmailed with a control file. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this, you've never seen a person more scared. I thought he was going to piss on the floor.
Wow.
It's something to watch. It is something to watch.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly to space, military, global turf wars. First story, you know, we've had an ongoing war we really haven't talked about, Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And now we see Saudi Arabia is planning to annex several Yemeni provinces, according to a report. And basically, you drill down the point here. According to the report, Saudi Arabia's decision comes as part of its plans to have access to the Indian Ocean, and they got a map here. It's okay map, but so Saudi Arabia's up here, okay, right, and Yemen's here. They've already got access to the Indian Ocean, which is right here.
Right.
Now, but they got to go. This is obviously a bottleneck, and by annexing these parts, they'll have much greater access to the Indian Ocean. Anyway, what's going on in that?
So, you know, we've said this a long time. The Bretton Woods system comes down, and then it's a free-for-all. Everybody's free to grab. In other words, you don't have a global cop, and whether you like the global cop or not, at least they ran a process that stopped the strong from grabbing from the weak. But to me, you know, you just have too many people with too much clout ready to grab from their weaker neighbors.
Right.
Right.
And Yemen is weak. I mean, that campaign... Right. You know, by Saudi Arabia included starvation. That was part and parcel of what they were doing.
So Yemen's been getting weaker and weaker. And for the last, you know, 2 years, I mean, particularly this year, Saudi Arabia's oil profits are flying. They're making a fortune. And the, you know, the rift with the U.S. between the oil producers and the dollar syndicate is such, they feel, even if Biden called up and said, you can't do this, they don't have to. You know, they've got the U.S. sort of in a corner. They don't have to obey.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they made a deal. I mean, as far as I know, they made a deal. You know, we get Yemen and the U.S. So, you know, so we're at the sort of state of slow burn implosion where these kinds of grabs are going to start to happen. We saw it last year with India and Pakistan. So, you know, India basically seizing land from the Pakistanis within their jurisdiction. So we're watching the big grab going on all around the planet, whether it's done in a bold way or a physical way like this, or Goldman Sachs going in and buying a whole housing development with
freebie
money. Make no mistake about it. One looks more civilized than the other, but it's not.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, next story in space, military, and global turf wars. This is another Scylla and Charybdis story from the opposite corner of the world.
Yeah, here we go.
From the Bangkok Post, skeptical ASEAN vis-a-vis maverick U.S. That is the head of Indonesia, okay? So we're going to have a conference over there or a summit. The timing and venue of the upcoming special summit between ASEAN and U.S. leaders later this week was extraordinary. By the way, this ASEAN... There's 10 ASEAN nations, you know, Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Singapore, Vietnam, Thailand. There's 10 of them, sort of. Indonesia is the biggest one.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Indonesia's got the population of Indonesia is like 275 million.
Right.
Indonesia's huge. It's bigger
than Japan. They're back in the oil syndicate. They got a lot of oil. Right.
Yep. It's bigger in terms of population than Japan and Korea combined by far. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that the Indonesia, being that large, is also part of the G20, okay?
Right.
So by way of that background, you could see what's going on here. 1 week before the much-awaited summit, Cambodia, Indonesia, and Thailand issued a joint statement reminding the international community that as hosts of three important summits in November, they should be given the chance to do their job without any pressure or interference from external power. It was an unprecedented move. It is an open secret that Indonesia, the chair of the G20, so not only are they a member, they're the chair, I didn't know that, has been under severe pressure from the U.S. and its allies to limit or even suspend Russia's presence at the G20 summit following its invasion of Ukraine. So there you have it. And, right. And the Indonesian president standing up saying, you need to back off.
Another significant country who is frustrated with the double binds and the incoherence of U.S. demands.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. But that's a story there where the U.S., you know, pick a side.
Right.
You know, it's Scylla or Charybdis. Pick one.
Right.
You know, but there in this story, they're getting pushback.
Right.
Yeah. But because
right.
You know, as you,
it's interesting, if you look at the countries that are going to come together here, a lot of what started to really encourage them to spend a lot more time communicating, planning, working on things, including lots of swap agreements among themselves, was the terror that the financial crisis shot through them.
Yeah.
Because they realized they saw the extent of the financial fraud and what it cost them. And they said, you know, we can't trust the Americans. We have to start building our own resiliency and arrangements.
Yeah.
So they've been working on this since 2008.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right, right.
Yeah, you'd think Malaysia would have started back in 1998 with the long-term capital management.
Oh, I think they did.
Yeah,
I think they did.
And in Asia,
you know, it's really funny when you go out to Asia. So when I was in Thailand in 2019, and you listen to all, and then when I did the research for State of Our Currency, if you look at all the things they're doing that are quiet and invisible, it's quite extraordinary because they, you know, I'm not saying they know what's going to happen, but they know when a global cop turns into just a global shakedown artist and it spirals down this badly, they know it's just a matter of time. And so they have to make other provisions. But they do everything they can to make it really practical. You know, you sit down with the Cambodians and figure out you can trade peanut butter for toilet paper. You know, it's very bottom up.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Okay, next story. The next story in space, military, and global turf wars is probably, it's one of the most fascinating stories to me this week. This is Russia opens fire on Israeli jets over Syria, according to a report. According to an unconfirmed report. But look at this. Tensions, okay, aside from, just take this. So the allegations, Russia's shot down some Israeli jets over Syria, which
what
a lot of people
What were they doing over Syria? Yeah.
Well, they've been over Syria a long time. And right. A lot of people have asked, why hasn't, you know, Syria's got the S-300. The Russia's over there. Why aren't they shooting down Israeli jets? And now they have, after all this time, okay?
Supposedly.
The report is unconfirmed.
Yeah.
But that's the allegation. But what is appears to me to have been confirmed is what I want to drill into in this story. It's like, this is getting hot, okay? Okay. Tensions between Russia and Israel have remained high since Russian President Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in February. This was intensified after comments at the beginning of May from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, as he said that Adolf Hitler may have had Jewish blood. After this, Putin offered an apology to Israeli Prime Minister Bennett, according to Israeli media outlets. However, Kremlin denied that Putin apologized to the Prime Minister and issued a statement detailing the phone conversation that the pair actually had. That's getting down and dirty.
You know, it's so funny. One of the challenges of doing what we do is there are so many times in the week where I have so much desire to run something down and figure out what's really going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just can't do every one. You really can't. And when I first started at this, I used to waste a lot of time trying to run down something. And sometimes I'd get it, sometimes I wouldn't. But a lot of times, even when I got it, it wasn't worth the rundown. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you look at something like this and that old desire comes back and you think, you know, I feel like, like I'm pulling the bridle back. No, 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 don't do that. Because, you know, who knows what you find if you go down this rabbit hole. But I would love to know the story on this one.
Well, it looks like Russia finally, to me, the story, Russia finally said, you know what, that Israeli story about Putin apologizing, it never happened.
Right.
And they published the minutes of the phone conversation.
So this gets back to what they did in the UN and the way they're handling biological warfare, which I think is very astute. Sager's tearing his hair out and he's saying they're bad at spin, but they're just very right. carefully stepping through. Here are the facts. They're being like Bruce Willis. You know, so Russia's playing Bruce Willis. And I think over time, it's a slow strategy, but I think over time, it's the strategy that could work here. But what you see, whether it's the Indonesians or the Indians or now Russia playing the game this way, you know, there is a global conspiracy that is not coordinated and is out of control of people saying, you know something, we're just going to keep starting to put the facts on the board. We don't care what the shriekometer says.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that makes life really interesting for the rest of us.
Russia does appear like they have a more of a dragnet approach. It's just the facts. No shrieking. Just here's what happened. Here's the minutes.
Right.
You look at them yourself. Okay, next story from Pakistan. Imran Khan, who had been deposed, apparently made a video.
And what I would describe was probably an illegal coup.
His being deposed was probably a legal coup. So he's out. But he says here, if something happens to me, I've recorded a video where I expose everyone involved in the conspiracy, in the coup. And he's got this video, and I'm not going to play it.
He shows it to a crowd. I don't know how many people in the crowd, but it could be millions. Yeah, I mean, he has a lot of popular support.
That's the thing about the video. I've watched it a couple of times, and the second time, I was like, wait a minute. It's a two-camera shot, and so you can see, let me cut over here. So you can see the one camera here is on him, okay? And it's brightly lit. You can see it's spot lit from the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. The light's going up. You can't see, the top of his head is very dark, but anyway. So, and the second camera is of the crowd. And there's, to me, it's like, well.
We're not sure it's the same place.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I will say this, Khan has tremendous popular support.
I don't doubt that. Yeah. I don't doubt that. But whether he would have really gotten up in front of a million people, given how unpopular it was and given the content of that message, which is, I've got a video on you people. I'm going to spill the beans if something happens to me. Would he have really, I don't know.
He might.
That's a risk. He might have.
You know, I think the chances of him doing that or something like that for a man in his position are very high.
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Okay. Next up, we have FedWatch. This story, interesting. Within days of Macron's stolen re-election, France rolled out digital ID.
What a surprise.
Yeah, here we go. Within 2 days of Macron's victory, France introduced an app called the Digital Identity Guarantee Service that will include last name, first name, date of birth, photograph, postal address, and email address. The app will connect to Twitter, Facebook, and other social exchange platform. Critics believe the app will be used as a tool for social control similar to China's social credit program. So the story here is really it's the timing. He gets elected and wastes no time rolling out the digital ID.
Right. Yep.
You know, any surprises there?
You always got to pay back your donors, right?
Yeah. Yep. Good point.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. He didn't waste any time on the payback. I'll tell you that. Okay. Next story. This is FedWatch 2. No surprise here. This is a video. Bill Gates' back company says lab-grown human milk may be just 3 years away. This is actually, the video is simply, it's just a CNN video with like, it's great. We've got synthetic milk that we're growing. It's just like mother's milk. We're growing it in a lab. And CNN is presenting it as, isn't this really positive? But the researchers here still are poking around, and they found out that the company they're talking about, which is headquartered in Cary, North Carolina, there is got Bill and Melinda Gates all over it.
So this story hits before suddenly the Shriekometer turns on like a campaign we're short of baby formula. It's unbelievable. And you think, okay, what's the game here?
Very good point.
Right.
Right.
So we're going to, Weston Price has a link on how to make raw milk baby formula if you need it. And we're going to put it up in the notes to ask Catherine this week. So it'll be there on the commentary. But, for anybody who needs baby formula, what's going on is very, very inconvenient, needless to say.
Yeah, I mean, there's four plants nationwide. And as you and I discussed, that story, though, about the baby formula, it's being hammered pretty hard by...
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Then there were two announcements. One, they're relaxing the safety standards so we can import baby formula. What does that mean? But to me, the other message here is this is what happens when you permit centralization. You don't have redundancy. You don't have resiliency.
Right.
Doesn't make any sense.
You have central control. They can control your life with a flick of a switch in a major way.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Keep it going with FedWatch. Our story from our favorite guy, Powell. Remember, by way of background, Powell, for months and months and months, said, no, the inflation you're seeing, this is a year ago, is transitory until it's entrenched. And now his tune has changed. Powell warns that taming of inflation, which is not transitory, as it turns out, will cause some pain. Okay? Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell has warned bringing inflation down to the U.S. Central Bank's target of 2% will cause some pain, he said, adding that tackling high prices without causing a recession may depend on factors outside of its control. What are the odds of a recession occurring, given his disclaimer? That's out of our control.
Goldman Sachs came out at the same time and said there's a very, 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 I think it was three verys, high risk of a recession. Now, if you look at the economy between insiders and outsiders, the recession is an outsider recession. It's not an insider recession. So we're talking about this like it's a natural recession in a business cycle. It's not that.
No.
So we were going to publish the SPAC analysis this week. It turns out we moved it to next week because we want to do Codex this week on the food control. And but you'll see with SPACs, you got $1 trillion pouring into all these companies to build the smart grid. There's no recession. It's boomland in smart gridville, right?
Yeah. So, on the one hand. On the other hand, the Fed is tapering. It is selling off assets to some degree. It's definitely raising interest rates.
Right.
And it's definitely, I'm going to wait another week, but I also track for the retail money supply. In other words, how much money is in our bank accounts? It's going down. And it dropped down 1 week.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, more than it had ever dropped at, more than it dropped down in 9/11.
You've pumped a ton of money out to outsiders. They have it stockpiled and are reinvesting and doing their thing. And now you're pulling the punch bowl and the insiders are choking more. Remember, the insiders have lost in the United States a million businesses. And now you're pulling the punch bowl away.
The retail money supply is a little trickier, though, because insiders have checking and savings accounts, too.
Right.
That's like, well, why? Anyway.
Right, but they're not all in the U.S.
Yeah, but they're tracked. It's U.S. bank accounts. Yeah, they're not in the U.S., but their bank accounts are,
Right.
So we'll take a look at that next week. But the Fed is definitely tightening up. And to the extent it is deliberately contracting the retail money supply, it is jimmying
up
the
odds. Taking away the punch bowl. Right.
Yeah. It's increasing the odds of a recession, no doubt about that. But I think, if that happens, they're going to turn around and do QE again, of course.
But it's not increasing the chances of a recession. There is a recession.
Yeah.
If you're an outsider, you're in a recession. You've been in a recession for 2.5 years.
Right.
Now, yes, there are labor shortages, and so some people have done better.
Right.
But I don't think the recession is coming. I think it's now.
It's here now.
If you're one of a million business owners who lost a business, you're in a recession.
Yes.
Right.
Right. I mean, just look at the number of people not in the labor force.
Right.
It's about to crack 100 million for the first time ever.
Right.
Well, shouldn't say that. It did spike up over 100 million briefly at the very front end of the pandemic. But anyway, you're right. It is a major recession going on and has been since March of 2020.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And on that pleasant note, let's go to the next story. Producer price inflation continues surging at 11%. Annual processed food increases now 34.8%. The headline here is there's inflation. Okay. So the way that he gets to 11% inflation is in this chart. He goes over to the annual column here. You can see change in the final demand from 12 months ago. These over here are the monthly figures. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is the annual figure. And then when you go down to the producer price index and food, he changes gears. The way he's gotten 34.8% is he's taken the April number of 2.9%. Not really sure you could see that. And multiplying that by 12. What he's not doing is taking taking the annual figure from the annual column 12 months ago, which if he used that, it wouldn't be 34.8. It would be 21.9. But, you know, we're splitting hairs here.
Right.
There's inflation and it's big time. It's not just 6%. It's a lot.
Right. And interestingly enough, in my experience, one way to deal with inflation is to go to buying unprocessed food and doing a lot more cooking. And there are ways to do that, organizing with neighbors and others that can dramatically, I mean, you can go down to the terminal market and buy wholesale and dramatically drop the costs, but you got to do unprocessed.
I'm doing a lot of cooking.
Right.
You know, I'll tell you, three times a week, I've got an Instant Pot. I put stuff in it. I got recipes, make my own stuff.
I just bought a slow cooker. So
that's funny. I bought the high pressure fast cooker Instant Pot.
Anyway, oh, really? Okay.
That's great. I love it. Anyway, next story, diesel fuel shortage set stage for next Biden created crisis. Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, Biden's got something to do with it, but if you want to blame somebody, it's come on. Okay. Anyway.
What's your feedback on diesel shortages around the country? Do you have any feedback on that?
No.
So I've been reading a fair amount of coverage of this, but I haven't been able to get a lot of feedback from subscribers on the ground, which is where I get comfortable that I really understand what's going on.
Yeah, me too. But we got the next best thing in this story. Okay, so let's cut to the story. I'll give you feedback of a different sort in a minute. But so the bottom line here, the Green New Deal energy policy of Joe Biden creates massive downstream consequences. We now have diesel fuel shortages beginning to hit the U.S. economy. And with scarcity come higher prices of an almost astronomical scale. The national average price of diesel is now $5.54 a gallon. They show this graphic over here. It's $6.59 in New York. Anyway, the next best thing, aside from anecdotes, personal confirmation, is what they got here. Let me go here. Love's Truck Stops, which I've been to plenty of those, with some 550 locations across 41 states, also seemed to confirm reports on social media Wednesday that says Love's and other truck stops, such as Pilot, were informing their fleet operators that shortages of diesel fuel on the East Coast may happen in the coming week at some stores.
Right.
So there you go. There's a report. That's the word on the street.
Right.
Is you get shortages coming.
Right.
So if it's bad now, it's going to get worse.
Higher prices to me don't necessarily mean shortages. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. Okay.
So the story I'll tell you, I was in Chicago last week, on some business, and the guy I'm meeting with, we were talking inflation, and he says, he says, look at this. And he pulls out his phone and he showed me a picture of a pump, just like the pump that we saw there.
Yeah.
He had paid $116 to fill up his car. I said, well, what are you driving? He says, it's a Volvo XC90. So I look it up. It's like the gas tank in it. It's an SUV.
Yeah.
It's less than 20 gallons. And I said, well, where'd you get your gas at? He says, well, it's premium. It's 92 or 93. And I got it at the corner of Armitage and the Expressway, which is known to be one of the most expensive.
Right.
But he says, but look at that. 116 to fill up a tank, less than 20 gallons. So it's like $6.50 a gallon for 93 octane in Chicago right now.
Jesus, put a down payment on a house or get a tank full of gas.
That's unbelievable. Anyway, next story in FedWatch from Australia. This one's pretty short and sweet. Australia state passes law banning growing your own food. Why would they do that? Well, of course they've got a reason. The reason for the change is biosecurity. We want you to not be able to grow food because it's biosecurity.
Even scarier, they got a big vote down there and labor, you know, I don't know how long it'll take to get accounted, but the Labor Party that's been doing these crazy things in Victoria, they're terrified they could win. But I just saw an announcement that Scott Morrison, the current prime minister, announced he's supporting WHO and the FAO on food and health. Very bad sign.
Very bad.
Right.
All bad. And the gloves are really coming off with this. All they need is a word. It's biosecurity.
Right.
No food for you, biosecurity.
Right. And the Australians, it's funny. Jason Bowden-Smith used to always tell me, he said, our mistake was we let them bring in the guns. So you still have a lot of countries where they haven't brought in the guns yet. And I just think if you're in a country or a state where they haven't brought in the guns, you need to understand this is where they're going.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Next story from Cheryl Atkinson. This is disturbing. But let's listen. This is just a video clip. It's just going to roll it here.
It sucks being set up by the government and surveilled by the government. And sometimes it takes far too long to be able to clear those matters up.
One little reported facet of my case is one of the federal agents involved in one of the operations against me said that they intended to plant child porn in my husband's computer. This is the FBI. There's been a case that's currently in litigation, unrelated, in which an FBI agent has testified that they did that. They have done that. It was not accomplished in my case. I guess the curtain was drawn on that facet of the operation prior to them doing it. But imagine how you ever get out of that. They knew we had a young daughter at home and had allegedly conspired to do that.
Wow.
Yep. That's how they do it. That's interesting. In my case, the FBI was supportive and helpful. But, you know, I have to tell you, whenever I see somebody, a freedom fighter prosecutor for child porn, you know, that's my assumption that there's a reasonable chance that this was done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Atkinson is an absolutely, she's done a very good job of bringing transparency to all the different computer games and tactics that they use to try and prosecute her and corner her. And she's done a good job at it. She's a very good reporter.
Yeah. A lot of integrity.
Yes.
Yeah. I forget who she left. She was with CBS.
I think she was Special Investigations for CBS, but
yeah.
It was a while ago.
When her stories started getting spiked, she said, "You know what? I'm out of here.
Right.
You're not doing that to me. Right. I'm not in this for the paycheck."
Mm. Right. And they have given her a hard time ever since, and she's done a great job building a new reporter career. In many respects, she's much more successful than she was then.
And the pushback, she's filed lawsuits.
Right.
But she won't hesitate.
Right.
Okay, next story, and the last story in FedWatch. This is really a graphic. Visualizing U.S. crude oil and petroleum product imports in 2021. So U.S. crude oil imports is a graphic here. I can't quite fit it. I'm going to try to shrink this down. There we go. That might work pretty well. Let's go one more. Anyway, you can see there, Canada is most of the U.S. imports.
Yes.
Followed by, looks like, other non-OPEC and Mexico.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. So,
big one here. I forgot. Should have mentioned this one. Look at this.
Yeah, almost 8% from Russia.
Russia, 8%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
So I love looking at graphs like this because I think it helps you, you know, when you're dealing in a situation where energy is such a big part of the headline in the politics, it really makes sense to just sit down and look at the statistics on, you know, I call it how the money works. How does the money work for this country? When a country is getting up and saying policy statement, yak, 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 I like to look at how their money works. And, you know, when you look at that, it's a reminder of how deeply tied that Canada and the United States are. They share a very long border and a lot of trade.
Yeah, the money really talks. When I was looking at sort of doing his background on ASEAN nations, you know, I was shocked Indonesia was that much bigger than the countries you always hear about.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was thinking the ASEAN nations was sort of the junior varsity Southeast Asia, you know, this little small country. Indonesia's huge. Mm-hmm.
And they have an incredible presence on the South China Sea.
It's Japan and Korea. That involves a lot of money flows.
Right.
That's why they get a lot of ink.
And it's interesting because if you think they hate the United States, you know, they have real concerns about China. And so if you look at all the relationships between the different Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, anybody with a big presence on the South China Sea, there's a lot of effort to sort of organize and trade with each other and deal with this Chinese juggernaut. So it's being a foreign minister of a country like Indonesia is a highly fascinating and complex challenge.
Gotta be, yeah.
right.
You can't, you know, we've got a meritocracy problem in the U.S. where we're just promoting, you know.
They don't have that problem.
We're just promoting ass kissers is what we've got in the U.S., to be blunt.
Right.
People who are going to toe the line no matter what.
Right.
And because the line gets worse and worse and worse, the quality of the people goes down and down and down. I mean, you have idiots in serious positions of power now, just absolute clowns. Not in Indonesia. That guy's a sharp cookie. You know, not in Finland either, you know.
Right.
Okay. Shifting gears, let's go to CBDC and crypto. We haven't done this in a while, but this is pretty serious, looks like to me. There's two stories here. This is the first one. Luna crypto crash, how UST broke, why it matters, and what's next. So what's going on here? What is unprecedented is the collapse of the Luna cryptocurrency and its associated Terra USD stablecoin, also called UST. So it's been a bad week for crypto. Everybody knows that, but they want to focus on one in particular here, UST and Luna. The UST coin is designed to retain value of a dollar at all times, but it was depegged last Monday on May 9th and has since fallen to just 17 cents. Then there's the Luna, the centerpiece of Terra's ecosystem. The coin's price fell from $116 in April to just a penny on Thursday. That's a drop. Wow.
Right.
Okay. So they explain how these are tied together, the coin and the stable coin, and why it retains value at a dollar. This writer says it all makes sense. But UST, which should be at a dollar, at the time of this writing, is worth 17 cents. So they say on May 7th, over $2 billion worth of UST was unstaked, means sort of, you know, hundreds of millions of that was immediately sold. It gets dumped, of course, when it goes below a dollar. Such huge sales push the price down to 91 cents. Investors are getting crushed. They're already flighty. They keep selling. Now it's fallen to a steady low of under 20 cents. Again, they're speculating here, but they quote this guy, this expert, Unesi. He's unsure whether the DPEG was caused by a coordinated attack or not, but said the responsibility is on crypto developers to create more secure systems. So this is a big, shocking bit of news in the crypto world that this stablecoin is not stable.
So this gets back to a lot of the conversation we've had about crypto and related issues. One is, we're talking about markets that are still novel, and therefore you don't have a lot of depth of liquidity. Nor transparency. And in recent period, you've got a lot of new retail investors coming in who are not necessarily got a long-term commitment to that position. You know, they're more speculators. And so you have a lot of people ready to be flighty, but you don't have the depth to handle them. And so you end up with a bank run that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
So that's part of the problem. The other problem is the, you know, whether it's the custodian or these other relationships, if you don't have high integrity, both ethical and competency backed up by real capitalization to deliver, for example, on a peg, it's not going to hold, and other people are going to, you know, you're going to get enemies who are trying to break it. So you don't have the you know, a lot of my sort of squabble with the Bitcoin folks is they don't have the integrity and the custodian arrangements, period. And not only that, most of them are very intelligent, wonderful people who've never been trained in what it takes to run a good custodian operation or right. those kinds of arrangements. And finally, I'll just say it again. I've never met a digital system which is trustworthy. And yeah. and the notion, you know, this is where we'll get in these fights where they say, oh, well, Fitz really doesn't understand how it works. And I may not understand the detail of this particular twist or that particular twist, yeah. but I've worked with digital systems, you know, from the first moment they hit, and I've never met one that was trustworthy, and, you know, it's a much longer conversation. And I think a lot of these people are young and they just don't know. And they certainly don't right. know how it works with the law. We've been through that. So,
yeah.
so it's like any new financial product, it's going to get shaken out, and the shakeout is going to hurt a lot of people, and it's very ugly. And I'll tell you what scares me to death. If you had a Luna trader who swapped at 116 and now has a tax liability, and their position is worth 17 cents, you know, they could end up in prison, John.
Yeah.
Because, you know, whenever these things happen, the IRS is, you know, the tax auditors are not far behind. So, you know, here we okay. go again.
Here we go again. And let's right. go to the second story. So where is all this going with the depegging of a stablecoin and this and really the ruinous decline of the price of the cryptocurrency there? Because people got wiped out. People, you know.
Right, right.
Where is all this headed? Okay, that's the next story. This story is somebody writing, like, basically, here's my read on this situation. And I know a guy who's really heavy into crypto and banking, knows a lot about both. He says, yeah, I agree with this. Unlock, the stablecoin ban will be international. So he thinks it's going to be a ban, this writer. He said, most stablecoins will be banned, and most of the world will adopt whatever the U.S. uses as its own laws, okay? The regulations rolled out aim to create a system of complete international transparency and control. And we move on down, and there's a right. there's pending legislation in the U.S. Get this. Here comes. You knew it was coming.
Right.
This is a quote from the statute. Beginning on the date of the enactment of this section, no person may issue, use, or permit to be used a digital asset fiat-based stablecoin that is not approved by the Secretary of the Treasury under subsection
B27. Right, the regulators are going to exercise complete control of all of this stuff.
Yep.
Right.
And here you go.
Right.
The Bank Secrecy Act is going to be amended to sanction the use of anonymity-enhanced convertible currencies and anonymizing services. In other words, your anonymity is going out the window via the Bank Secrecy Act. In other words, the Treasury's going to step in here.
So the only question is, did Mr. Global create and destroy the latest stablecoin, or did they just destroy it? I mean, you know, because it's right. another enormously coinky-dink event.
It is, right.
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 But we knew it was coming. Yeah. But, you know, moral of the story to anybody here, if you swap escrow your taxes at the swap close in the fiat currency that you owe taxes, please do it. And if you have gains and winnings in cryptocurrency, you know, play from your winnings. And if you think that an all-digital financial transaction system is a good idea, you better start to change your mind and use cash. So.
Boy.
I mean, there are ways you manage dealing in a speculative, illiquid market. And one of them is not to bet the ranch on something that could go from 116 to 17 cents. How long did it take?
It's like a weekend. I mean, it was so right. fast.
Right.
But, you know, with that story in the background, it's so easy to foresee. It's so predictable. The hearings in Congress, oh, I had everything. You know, there's a violin playing as a person said, oh, I lost everything. Oh, wouldn't it help you? Wouldn't you like the Treasury to step in with more Oh, yes.
Oh,
that
yes.
would be wonderful. I mean, and because there's no transparency there, you know, they might as well just hire actors to testify in front
right.
of Congress about, I mean, they don't have, there's no right. record of any of this, right?
Right.
Anyway, no official record.
Right.
Okay, let's change gears to Farmageddon. This story, pretty straightforward. From the Visual Capitalist, how synthetic bio could change life as we know it. They call it SynBio for short. Here's a little graphic. It's look at its big areas. Health and human performance, $1.3 trillion. These are projections. Agriculture and food, $1.2 trillion. So, it's, you know, things going into your body. That's what the powers that they be are interested in. And let's just highlight a couple sections here. SynBio is a field of science that redesigns organisms in an effort to enhance and support human life. Okay, it sounds great. This rapidly growing field of science is expected to reach $28.8 billion by 2026. So it's in its infancy, to be sure. And then let me look at this. Couple of potential risks of SynBio. Here we go. Unintended biological consequences.
Really? No, you kidding. Think?
Yeah. And bioweaponry could be used to recreate viruses, manipulate bacteria, and make it more dangerous if used with ill intent. Should that actually happen?
So this is already happening. If you go listen to, in our food series, we did an interview a couple years ago with a wonderful professor, retired professor, Professor Emeritus from Purdue University in Agriculture. He had worked at Fort Detrick in biowarfare before he became an academic professor in agriculture, and he described the mysterious ingredients, nanoparticles, that they were finding in the food. And it's one of the more terrifying interviews that we've ever done at the Salieri Report, and it's when I really started to bang the drums about trying to get food that has integrity from sources you know you can trust.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So I think we ought to call it synthetic news and throw that in the synthetic graphic.
Yeah, right. Right.
Well, but it takes synthetic news to market synthetic food and synthetic drugs, right?
Yeah, right.
Right. Right.
The stablecoin story had a synthetic feel to it, like
there's
so
something you know, again, I say, you know, that's one of the ones you look at and you say, I really would like to take a week to figure out what's really going on here. Yeah.
But, you know, it's opaque.
Except for this, one of the things I'll tell you is we have the most amazing subscribers. And sometimes after you and I say this in Money and Markets, I start to get all these posts and subscriber input.
True.
And it's amazing. Yep. And you go, like, you know, I try and send you some of them because you're like, wow, okay, we can understand.
Yeah, right. The meat tick is real.
Yeah.
Okay, next story in Farmageddon. Pretty straightforward here. Vaccinated and sudden death medical doctors. Here, big deal. Vaccinated doctors are dying and unvaccinated doctors are quitting or being fired. Big question, who will run the hospitals?
Very great big question.
Yep. According to Forbes, get this, about one-third of hospital staffs in the U.S. are not yet vaccinated. That's stunning. I didn't know it was that high.
In most that of does the, not it, surprise me, given the feedback I've gotten.
It's one-third.
Right.
So they say if most of these staff end up quitting or being fired, who is going to be left to run the hospitals, especially if doctors start or dying off
right.
in droves, and they are, and they just go through. These doctors, look at these. These are young people.
Right.
Dying.
Right.
I mean, they look healthy.
Right.
You know? Just dying off. So there's a ratchet wrench going on here. You know, people, right. Look at this guy. This guy is
right.
Unbelievable. Anyway, so it's a ratchet wrench. You know, people, they're not vaccinated, getting fired, and then the current crop is getting smaller.
There was a lot of discussion in Sweden this weekend from different doctors in different countries talking about provision they're making to provide health care, you know, the unvaccinated doctors finding ways of doing real health care and how we find each other.
Yeah. Okay. The next story is interesting, and I think it actually may be worse than we're being led here to believe, but let's look. The story is NIH scientists received estimated $350 million in royalties since 2009, according to a report. And then you drill right. into this. We'll see about that. Royalties from 2009 to 2014 that add up to, you know, 22,000 royalty payments to 17,000 scientists. With the redactions, it's impossible to tell how much each scientist received. Only the aggregate total in each department, which adds up to $134 million in this time period, okay? But there's another set of 1,800 royalty pages meant to cover 2015 to 2020 has yet to be handed over to the open books, but it is estimated that payments in this period reached a total of $350 million by 2020. Query what that estimate is based on. You know,
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Read Kennedy's book, because if you look at the conflicts of interest, they're beyond, you know, they're just unbelievable. I know what I went through as a public appointee and a presidential appointee to rid myself of any ethical conflicts. And the fact that it's deteriorated this far is just astonishing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go back to one more thing in the story. If you look at who's received these, among the royalty recipients are National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Anthony Fauci, who received 23 royalty payments. Now, we don't know how much that was, but he's getting money. These people are getting paid. You know, you remember in the tech, when the tech bubble broke, CNBC started requiring people to come on and say whether they were invested in the stock. I think the people like Fauci ought to be required to say at the front of their testimony, I received money from the pharmaceutical industry in the following areas.
If you look at the effort that was made to prove that I had an offshore account, and then they discovered, oh, I didn't have an offshore account. You know, one of the things it told me was, you must be the only person in Washington who doesn't have an offshore account. And what I will tell you is, I think the kickbacks, the illegal kickbacks, including to offshore accounts, are unbelievable. You know, a bureaucrat gets a credit card and they can use it to do all sorts of things and buy all things. It goes to an offshore account. You know, there's no connection between them and the account. There's no connection between their bank account and the account, but they can just, you know, they can just party all night with this little special credit card.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think
the kickback, credit card.
Right. I think the bribes and the kickbacks are off the charts.
I agree. You have to wonder, like, who is paying these people?
Right.
And that's our next clip of this guy. I want to just run this clip talking about how, listen to this. He just says this, that humans in meat, his opinion on meat. Get this.
So I'll give two examples. So one is that people eat too much meat. Right. And if they were to cut down on their consumption on meat, then they would it would actually really help the planet. But people are not willing to give up meat. Yeah, you know, some people will be willing to, but other people, they may be willing to, but they have a weakness of will. They say, wow, this steak is just too juicy. I can't do it. I'm one of those, by the way. So, you know, but so here's a thought, right? So it turns out that we know a lot about, so there, we have these intolerance to, for example, I have milk intolerance. And there's some people are intolerant to crayfish. So possibly we can use human engineering to make it the case that we're intolerant to certain kinds of meat, to certain kinds of bovine proteins. And there's actually analogs of this in life. There's this thing called the Lone Star tick, where if it bites you, you will become allergic to meat. I can sort of describe the mechanism. So that's something that we can do through human engineering. We can kind of possibly address really big world problems through human engineering.
So the reason I sent this to you, you know, we had some great subscribers write in and say this Lone Tick thing is real. But then I got a wave of highly intelligent feedback of why some people believe that some of the mysterious ingredients, you know, for years we've been documenting and trying to figure out what all the mysterious ingredients are. The mysterious and secret ingredients in vaccines did not start with the COVID-19 injections. This has been a big problem for a while, and there's a group of Italian researchers who blew up the story in 2017 because they went through and did serious looking at and in the vaccines and discovered not only did you have all this stuff that wasn't supposed to be in there and wasn't disclosed, but the very things that were supposed to be in there to do whatever it was supposed to do weren't there. So,
wow. You know,
there was a big problem with what was supposed to be there wasn't there, and what wasn't supposed to be there, was there, and nobody, you know, they could figure out what some things were, but they literally got to the point where they said, there's a whole bunch of stuff in here. We don't even know what it is. And we can't unpack what it is anyway. So,
and there's so much of it that it displaces the stuff that's supposed to be there. It's advertised.
I mean, the whole thing, you know, you're talking about, you know, this is more than just a quality control problem. And it's the same thing we saw with the whistleblowers on Pfizer talking about, you know, this is not a quality control with the bad batches.
Right.
Anyway,
Yeah.
So I got a lot of very intelligent feedback of people who believe that some of the secret ingredients are, you know, relate to trying to make people allergic to meat, and that it's a plan. No, I don't know, but
who knows? But I mean,
if you look at what's been going into these injections, at least for a long, long time, I don't put anything past these guys.
Yeah, I mean, once it's infected with fraud, and it is fraud, right? You're concealing material information from people, and you're telling them it's safe and effective, knowing damn well it's not safe and effective. It's dangerous. It could kill you. If you're going to go fraud, go all the way. So the question is, you know, why are the powers that be so hell-bent on getting these needles into arms? What is in them? And that's the next story. Like, look how serious this is about getting it. Look at this next story. California bill to let 12-year-old children get vaccinated without parental consent passes the Senate. Here's the bill. SB 866 would allow kids to get any vaccine without their parents' knowledge, including the COVID-19 jabs. Okay, and California is not alone in this. Alabama, South Carolina, Oregon, and Rhode Island. But what is Alabama doing? What are these states doing in here? You know, allow teenagers to get vaccinated without their parents' consent. Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. allow children age 11 and up to consent to their own COVID-19 vaccines. And in San Francisco, the age is 12 and older, CBS reports.
And if you look at what some people do to bully those kids, it's unbelievable.
Oh, I can only imagine.
We did an interview with Jennifer Walters. So Jennifer Walters is starting a series on the Slayer Report called The Health Series. And she was an RN whose child was vaccine injured. And she has a phenomenal record for, you know, more than a decade of helping her own child heal, but working and networking with other people dealing in similar cases of vaccine injury. And she is a wealth of how to take responsibility for your own health. And sort of all the different possibilities of, you know, getting the best from the traditional system and getting the best from, you know, what you can do yourself or from sort of cash practitioners. Anyway, one of the stories she tells is she said, in my RN training that I had before I had my son, I was taught that if my hand slipped and the vaccine vial fell and broke, that I or somebody with a biohazardous suit had to clean it up. In other words, you couldn't just clean it up. You had to have a biohazardous suit on to clean it up.
Whoa.
Right. That's how she's trained as an RN. And she said, what was wrong with me that knowing that I needed a biohazardous suit to clean it up, I would be willing to let it be injected into my child's body, you know, like a tiny little baby.
Don't breathe it in. Instead, don't breathe it in. That's dangerous, but it's okay, right in your bloodstream, going to your organs directly.
Right. And she said, what disassociation was operating in me? And as she describes it, we did that in the introductory, interview. It's about 4 or 5 weeks ago. It's so powerful when you listen to it. And, you know, because we've all been there. We've all made these mistakes.
Yeah.
And you realize, you know, I'm missing some sequential logic in this.
Yeah, right.
Right, right.
Yeah, I've got some serious cognitive dissonance going on.
Well, part of it is, if you're a person who has empathy, it's very hard for you to fathom that the people running this don't, and they've managed through a variety of very sophisticated control mechanisms to get enough people to go along with implementing it that we can be where we are. That's hard. It's hard.
Right, it is. Right.
Right.
But here's the deal. Once the scales come off the eye, once the penny drops, that's it. There's no going back.
Right. But then you're ready. You're in a position to duck and bob and weave and navigate.
Right.
You know, as long as we can stop these big top-down systems from going into control like the CBDCs, like the digital ID, and like what the WHO's about to do.
Yeah, right. Or what the WHO's about to try to do.
Right.
How they would pull that off in the U.S., I don't know. But let's turn from Farmageddon to pushback, which is a happier topic. The next story is Rand Paul. It concerns the disinformation czar. We've had a couple of weeks now running. We've talked about Nina Jankowicz, Biden's nominee for the disinformation czar, new position. But this video here, Rand Paul, you can see the title of the video, "We're going to shut it down." he's talking about, we're going to shut that down. So that's good to see him standing up on that. Do you know anything more about that?
No, he cracked me up.
Yeah.
Well, because it's, you know, in the same week, he's going after the disinformation czar, and he's blocking the $40 billion to Spectre. So.
Right. He's being a royal PIA.
Well, here's what's interesting. Yeah. If you look at the effort to really harm him physically,
yeah,
you know, it's amazing he's come back, you know, with at least the courage he's come back. So, you know, that's a man who's staying in the arena and doing battle.
That's good.
Yeah. So he and Massey are both from Kentucky. And of course, Massey is one of my complete favorites. And you sort of wonder what's in the water in Kentucky. One of the things I know is they're very well armed. I'm across the border in Tennessee and we're very well armed too. So you've got like a, you know, a little Second Amendment enclave there.
That's good. Good to have. I mean, what rational person wouldn't be armed now, given what's going on all around you? Anyway, let's continue with pushback. This one a little closer to home. Here we go. Catherine Austin Fitz and Professor Richard Werner and Mads Palsvig are taking questions. What's going on here?
So this was the conference at Malmo. Great conference. Mads Palsvig, who is a politician with a party called JFK 21, in Denmark, Malmo's right across the border from Denmark, had a conference and called all, you know, just a huge number of freedom fighters. It's called the Northern Light Convention. You know, there's a website. We'll have the link, and the links are Money and Markets. And you can go see the program. It was live stream, got very good audience, and the videos will now start to roll out. They'll put up an edited version of the whole live stream, but we'll break them down and they'll roll out over time. So we've got some excerpts that are very choice.
Okay, so let's get into those. Let's just roll those. Here we go.
This is Christine Anderson, a member of parliament from Germany in the European Parliament.
But apart from that, the euro should have never been introduced. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's ridiculous to think you can impose a single currency on different economies where you have no foundation, a common structure in laws, in the social welfare system, and all of this. It was never supposed to work, actually, because anyone knowing a little bit about economy and money, and I would assume that most finance ministers should know a thing or two about that, it was clear it cannot work. You know what the real purpose of the euro is? To plead out every single European people. Everyone. It started with the Greek. But it will go on. Germany is going to be possibly last because we might be the strongest, but they will get to us too, just as they will do in France and Italy and Spain, everywhere. This is the real purpose of the EU, the euro. And, you know, telling you, it creates prosperity and it keeps the peace in Europe. Really? Look around. Prosperity? When? Where? On what planet? And then you have peace. The euro is basically a financial nuclear bomb. It divides the European countries, but it does not combine them.
Okay. The next clip is, I think, our man Richard Werner, right?
Yeah, he did a great job. Great speech. And then on several panels, but this is the panel right after his speech. It's Mads Palsvig, myself, and Richard.
Okay. All right. Let's get this clip.
It's possible that even if you have to have CBDC in some form, that you're not destroying the banking system. If you do it the way China is doing it, Now, you have to remember, China only recently introduced their banking system, and it seems they were not willing to already give it up. They have already CBDC. It's still a pilot project, but it's introduced, you know, among millions of people already. But it was introduced on purpose in such a way that it would not harm the banking system, and therefore is a more truthful sort of update of the old paper money. But of course, it still has the control aspect. So at least it's not killing the banking system. The way they do this is by requiring you to have a bank account in order to get CBDC. So it's not a direct account at the central bank. It's only through your bank that you can get it. You see how simple that is? And of course, could be done over here, but they're not discussing it. Say, the ECB is not discussing it because you see their agenda is to get rid of banks. But this alternative exists. But then, of course, the key problem is this control aspect, which at the moment they haven't stepped up in China, but that can be introduced any time. And that, of course, is a concern. Also, they never talk about the nature of this CBDC. What is it actually going to look like? They never talk about that. Right. But I heard one European central banker tell me what it's going to look like. He saw it. He was invited to one of the old central banks in Europe that are very much promoting this, and they showed him. And you know, he's a top executive director of another central bank in Europe, and there's no reason to believe that he was telling me a story. And it was around this large and would be implanted under your skin. So that is the plan.
Right.
And of course, that has other implications on top of what we've mentioned, on top of the control aspects, because that actually enters your body. In my view, violates human dignity, and can be then used for even in terms of functionality beyond the monetary and economic transaction purposes. So highly dangerous and definitely something we have to oppose. And so using cash is one of the things we can do to make sure that it will be, the hurdle will be higher for the central planners to introduce the CBDC.
Wow.
Cash Friday and every day, use cash as if your life depended on it, because it does.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right. Richard is a brilliant and brave man. You know, there's nobody, I would say, you tell me if you agree, alive today who understands more about central banking and the banking system. Absolutely brilliant guy.
Right.
For him to tell this story shows you how dire he thinks our circumstances are and the importance of pushing back. So every person has got to push back now.
Yeah, and he's been, you know, he's got a long history going back to the 90s, mid-90s,
right.
with central banks. So when he says he knows somebody who told him this, he knows somebody who told him
He knows
him
somebody
that.
Who told I mean, he's a person of extraordinary integrity in my experience. I just...
Yeah.
You know, I was there. He's telling the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've ever since I found that paper by him from 2014.
Yeah. Well, it was so funny. Like, your presentation was great because because we pre-recorded, I was trying to get you to come to Sweden, but then you had business conflicts, so you couldn't. But we did a pre-record last week after Money and Markets, and it really worked. But he had just given the presentation, and we had done the panel, and then we brought you in, and you mentioned that paper, reaffirming what he had said. He described the paper and talked about it, and it was like we had scripted it, but we hadn't.
Yeah, right. We hadn't. Yeah. It was just a happenstance. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
Okay, I think that does it for pushback, and now it is time for charts.
Wee. Okay.
All right. Let's get into it. Here we go.
Okay. So this is the U.S. dollar index, and as I said, it spiked. It was at 103 when we did this, but it did spike up to 105, which I find frightening. But you have an upward slope, and if it consolidates down and then heads back up again, if we get a higher high, we are really in uncharted territory for the recent period. So.
That's a big move.
Both on interest rates and U.S. dollar index. The big question I have is, are we going to see a higher high now?
No, that's a I mean, the dollar is such like a, it's like an iceberg to see it
right.
move
so
like
it's,
that.
Right, so it's up almost 8% for the year.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Okay. That's, yeah.
Let's go to the TNX, Treasury 10-year.
Right, so this is the 10-year yield. And again, following the same pattern, it's gone up, it's consolidated back, it's climbing again. If we get a higher high, you know, and if Powell does what he says he's going to do, it's likely, you know, we're going to keep being in new uncharted territory because, again, we've had this 40-year bull market in the bond market. It's still, you know, it's clearly over, and we just have to see how high it climbs. Now, one of the things Werner did this weekend is he pointed out that higher interest rates can lead to more growth, but of course, it's for the people who have capital and are getting the higher interest rates. So the savers are going to get more money, and you have a lot of financial institutions that are going to benefit, including some who've really suffered from the low rates.
Huh. So that's going up. Now let's look 30-year. It's up too. No surprise.
Yeah. It's the same. Are we going to get a higher high? And I, you know, it certainly looks like the answer is yes.
Yeah, right. Sure does.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Let's keep it going. Here we go. It's a very tight three-race horse race, all down.
Right. So as I've said many times, if you get 150 basis point rise within a year, the stock market can digest it. If you look at all the different things going on, as well as the rise in rates, stock market can't digest it. So S&P down 14.5%, the Chinese market down more. And it's funny, the Chinese market had really fallen, was underperforming Europe, and then the one in the middle is Europe. But now they're kind of converging in the, you know, let's share a pain territory. So, you know, down 14.5% to 16.5%. So stock market is struggling. I'm still a great believer in the planet equity scenario, but we are long overdue for a major consolidation, and I think we're getting it.
Yeah, boy, that's a three-horse race, and it is tight. It's coming down on the wire, right?
Right.
I mean, essentially, those three are indistinguishable.
Right. And what's interesting, one of the things people have pointed out, I never paid much attention to the argument that Bitcoin was inflation protection. You know, but if you look at how cryptos are trading, you know, the punch bowl's coming out of everybody. It's not just, it's not just equity and real assets. Commodities, of course, flying. But as we said last week, anybody with a bond portfolio thought they're going to be protected using bonds is hurting. Anybody who thought their, you know, their precious metals was going to be a glorious inflation protection is hurting, particularly if they're in silver. And crypto is hurting. So, you know something? There's no financial product that can protect you from Spectre.
Yeah.
Right.
Ain't that the truth? You got that right.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Bitcoin, not protected either.
So this is a particularly painful meltdown because if you look at where we were in November, you know, this is more than a 50% pull down. So if you look at the equity markets, you know, a major correction, 10% is a correction. You know, when you hit 35%, that's a major correct. So 25 to 30 is major. Below 35, then you're talking about, are we moving to a bear? So this is a, for, you know, more than a 50% meltdown. That's not a correction. That's
bear territory.
That's definitely bear territory. Now, I still believe they're going to pump it some more. And Bitcoin is the crypto that has the most currency. But this is very, very painful, particularly for the guys who were trading at the top and not escrowing their, you know, their tax money.
Yeah. Boy.
Yeah. This is why I'm always telling you, you know, play from your winnings. If you're dealing in a speculative market, just take your
get it off the table.
Yeah, keep taking your principal out and play from your winnings.
Yeah.
You know, we were always there are lots of basic rules that traders use for a speculative market. It's one of the reasons I like Rambus. So I told you, did I tell you the story about Rambus? So he was trading Rambus stock, the Rambus technology, coming into the, you know, as the internet bubble went up and up and up. And his wife threw a fit and she said, you know, you pull enough principal out so we can build a new house, pay off our cars. So they literally, he pulled the money. They apparently got a case of beer, sat and they burned down the old house, which is where we live. It's much cheaper to do it that way than to take it down. And then had enough money to buy two brand new cars and build a new, and their house is just beautiful. I mean, just a beautiful country, you know, on top of the hill kind of, I mean, it's just beautiful. And he did. And literally it was days or weeks later that the whole internet bubble just crashed. And that's how you do it, you know.
Rambus, the OG crypto Rambus. I never heard that. Yeah.
Oh, that okay. Was that. I mean, that was internet stocks, right?
Yeah, I remember. Right. I remember. Yeah. I mean, I remember numbers with Rambus. Like it went from 40 to 480. People were like, "Whoa!" You know.
Yeah, he got out. He got out right at the top, and you know, part of it was his technical analysis, but part of it was his wife.
Right. Let's be honest. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's move to commodities here. Here we go. Our favorites, heating oil near the top, VIX 33, you know, middle of the winners, and then lumber dead last, minus 31%.
Welcome to real risk, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
So here's my question, and I don't have a good beat on this. All the folks that started to learn how to trade or to manage money or invest after the Fed put went into place, you know, during the financial crisis. And they've always lived in a world of a zero to negative VIX. How are they making the adjustment?
Great question. I don't know.
I don't know.
Great question.
Yeah. There were, I'll never forget one of my old Dillon Reed partners talking about what happened when all the youngsters in 2008 who'd never lived through a down market.
Yeah, right.
What it was like for them to make the cultural adjustment to the financial crisis. And of course, then the Fed pulled them out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Fed. And the Fed's done that. Like you said, there's a generation of people who don't know what a down market is.
Right.
They're going to find out, but you know, they don't know yet.
Oh, I think they've found out now. Question now is, have they figured out how to trade it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for charts. So we want to kind of wind it down here with, we'll start with reader comments. Somebody had asked about MMT, like modern monetary theory, and what's going on with MMT. And my answer on that is I've got a link to a critique of MMT in the links that come with the show. And it's a critique of MMT by the American Monetary Institute, which is a group of people who really just are about the nuts and bolts of monetary theory. And they just sort of tell it like it is. MMT is baby with the bathwater, okay? There's some MMT stuff. MMT is really good when it comes to double entry accounting. Because remember, in a debt-based monetary system, you always have, it's a liability and an asset. And you always have to keep that in mind. Because one person's liability is someone else's asset. And MMT is very good with handling sort of the ins and outs and the piping of that, sort of the plumbing of that. Where MMT, from my point of view and from AMI's point of view, goes off the rail is, you know, there's a bunch of rules that govern the creation and disposition of money.
Right.
Okay. There's laws that talk about that. And MMT doesn't talk about this. MMT is sort of a club of people who started MMT, the movement back in the aughts, the early 2000s, 2008, back in that period. And they always refer to each other. It's sort of like Kelton says this and Randall Ray says that. It's like, well, forget Kelton and Randall Ray. What does the law say? What's the Treasury circular say? What does the Supreme Court say? You know, what does the law say? What's the Federal Reserve accounting manual say? And they never cite that. And I think one of the reasons they don't ever cite it is the MMT is really big on pushing the notion that all money is debt and all debt is money, and they've always been the same. And they cite this paper by a guy who wrote it back in 1913 saying money is debt and debt is money, and it always has been. And that is historical and factual nonsense.
Right.
It hasn't always been money. It has been money only in the modern era. And there are plenty of examples of things that are money that are not debt and vice versa.
Right.
And legally, again, legally, you know, your checking account, the money in your checking account doesn't count as money. It's actually legally it's treated as a debt, and MMT will never own up to that. Their notion seems to be like, don't worry about the debt in the U.S. debt is good, deficit spending is good. Don't worry about the fact that the Treasury owes the money to the Fed. The Fed is a public institution, which it isn't. We know, right. We've covered that many times. So anyway, the critique of MMT by AMI is worth looking at. Although, like I say, when it comes to the double entry accounting stuff, yeah, MMT gets a lot right, but they just take it too far.
Well, I have a couple of problems with MMT. One is, so go back, if you look, I think it was Guernsey, if the story of Guernsey, when Guernsey to finance a series of infrastructure projects just issued currency, which is the equivalent of Treasury issuing paper with no debt. And the investments were very productive. And if you look at the contribution to creating far more wealth and growth, you know, it was a huge success. Okay?
Yeah.
And part of the issue is, what did the money get spent on? Because if you're spending money and people are all sitting around watching TV and acting incoherently, you're going to get a very different result than if you're financing a series of projects that significantly improve the health and well-being of the people in that society or the infrastructure that supports them. So, you know, they try and talk about it as if it's divorced from productivity. And part of it, my problem is, if you look at the people really pushing it, are pushing it so they can do a universal basic income so they can exercise complete control. Okay?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one. The other thing is MMT is like giving a economy lecture in Disney World where the only thing that's true is Minnie and Mickey.
Right.
And the whole world underground doesn't exist, and half of the economy we're just going to pretend doesn't exist. And so we're already in Disney World. And I've had it with Disney World economics. I don't have time to pretend away the real world anymore. It's not a useful assumption.
Yeah. One of the first things in the critique by AMI is a quote from Alexander Del Mar. He says, you know, it's way easier than reading the history of money and the facts on money. It's way easier to imagine what it is and to work from that basis than it is to actually wrestle with facts and logic and
reality.
Right.
So I want to talk about what systems we're going to use while Spectre's in control.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea of giving Spectre the right to play modern, you know, MMT with our credit and our money is not appealing to me. So,
right. And MMT will tell you, well, the Fed's fine. You know, it's not maybe not the debt-based monetary system. It's not the ideal solution, but it's the best one we have, which I think is just categorically false.
Well, the best one they have for Spectre to, you know,
finish
locking in its position and injecting poison in our arms and everything else. If you think the Fed is doing just fine, take a look at Powell's face. Fed's not doing fine.
No, he's concerned. These guys, Bernanke, they never have poker faces, do they?
Well,
they do, but they're terrible.
Well, I think Powell is very good at poker faces, but if you look at his sort of energetic aura, this is a man who's smashing into a force field, and it doesn't feel, you know, he's being hit with a battery ram every day.
Yeah, and he looks grim.
He's at the intersection between, you know, between what the shriekometer is saying and the official reality and having to deal with reality.
Yeah, he's got a Scylla and Charybdis of his own.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it could be worse. We could be pal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
Okay, so ladies.
Previous wrap-ups. Let's just.
Yeah, that's right. So we've done two wrap-ups on space. One was Space Here We Go in 2015, and then in 2017, Who's Who and What's Up in the Space-Based Economy. And each time, John, it was so funny. People would say, you know, what's with this space thing? And they didn't see the role that space was going to play in the smart grid and the move to central control and the extraordinary money that was going to flow into space. We'll talk about it a little bit more next week when we do the SPACs report, because space was one of the target industries. But, you know, the space race is on. And part of it was the U.S. setting up something in violation of the space treaty, saying private companies can, you know, you land on an asteroid, John Titus, you can make it, you know, Titus World. You'll own it.
Fantastic. And there's hearings this week on UFOs, no?
What in the world is that? It's a Democrat from Indiana who's leading the hearings. When I heard it, I just started laughing. I thought, okay, what are they trying to protect against? Right after I heard that, the next headline in was Bank of England governor announces food shortages and worldwide famine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so you got to know that the reporters are all going through his trash trying to figure out where he gets his food. Anyway, so it's, you know, we're definitely going into summer, but things are, don't expect a vacation at the beach. Things are going to get more interesting.
Yeah, no vacations at the beach and not a walk in the park. Yeah, they're getting real choppy.
Yep. Okay, friction rising. Okay, John Titus, next week we have no money in markets.
Right. We have a fortnight without money in markets. We'll be back
in
2 weeks.
So as the headlines pile out, I start getting these messages saying, oh, my God, I can't wait for new money markets.
Yeah, right.
They keep saying, don't you want to do one every week? And I said, no, you know, we need a week every month to really think.
Yeah. You do, really do. It's really you a, do. Just take a pause and sort of, you know, reflect.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's always a pleasure. I look forward to doing Money in Markets with you 2 weeks now from, and just, I want everybody to digest what Richard Warner said, and now's the time to take action.
Yeah. Use cash.
Okay. Use cash.
We'll see you in a couple weeks then.
Thanks, John.
Bye.